Shrink Wrap Radio number 724, The Way Marketing Mostly Reshapes Our Brains.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are neuroscientist Matt Johnson, PhD, and marketer Prince Gurman, co-authors of the book Blindsight, The Way Marketing Mostly Reshapes Our Brains. According to their website, they, quote, explore how marketing taps every aspect of our mental lives, covering the neuroscience of pain and pleasure, emotion and logic, fear and safety, attention and addiction, and much more, close quote. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Matt Johnson and Prince Gurman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. Are you really a prince? I have to ask you about that.
Firstly, thank you for having us, Dave. No, that's not a name you pick for yourself, unless, of course, you are the prince. That is a name left from your mother. So, no.
Well, clearly your parents held you in high esteem. But it's a lot to have to live up to.
It is. It is. I'd rather have low expectations so I can consistently exceed them, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it's really a privilege to be able to speak to the two of you. I've gone through your book. I want to congratulate you on what a fine job you guys did. It's so like chock full of great information and factoids, you know, that seem like they're really important. It must have been a lot of work to pull all of that together, I would think.
It was. Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. It was definitely a labor of love, for sure. Lots of, hours poured into it and a few sleepless nights in there. But no, we're really glad that it's come off. And thank you very much for your kind words about it.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that you two are partners in a company called Pop Neuro. And, as I was trying to figure out everything about you guys.
Yeah.
So what's Pop Neuro? What's that about?
At Pop Neuro, we teach ethical application of neuroscience to marketing.
All right. I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Because we'll probably talk about ethics somewhere along the line here, because that's been kind of a red flag for me recently.
Yeah.
And it's been a red flag for a while. But when I saw and I'll make reference to this later, to the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. That really pushed my buttons, because I thought I knew all about, the kinds of manipulation that was going on, but that brought it home in such a concrete way that it got me nice and upset. But I'm not going to take that out on you, particularly now that I hear that you guys are concerned about ethical applications of neuroscience.
You know, Matt and I are very thankful that documentaries like Social Dilemma and The Great Hack a year or two ago, we're very glad that that's bringing behavior science to the forefront. And it's really exposing, on the outside, it's a beautiful statue. And as you zoom in further and further into what happens when tech accidentally meets behavior science with the same mentality of tech and startup applied to behavior science, you keep zooming in and you see a lot of these cracks. And, that's we're happy to see that. The second thing I want to say is I don't think Social Dilemma went far enough. I think it is a excellent narrative about tech designers and tech product managers who stumbled across behavior science without having a Matt Johnson in the room, right? To guide them through. And I'm from the tech world, and I know metrics are keep people on your site, right? The time on site model that meets behavior science. They did expose that, which is nice. But although the three of us can sit here and point a finger at Facebook all day long, and we'd probably be right in doing that, I don't think Social Dilemma put enough onus on the consumers, right? It didn't ask the question, the million-dollar question, which is no one wants to pay for apps. How in the world do you expect them to make money if you, me, and Matt want to keep using WhatsApp and Instagram and TikTok and whatever the new one is and Skype, right? And Gmail and not pay a penny? We've gotten entitled as consumers, and tech companies are not nonprofits, and they're finding ways to monetize. Now, we don't, now that it's coming out how they're monetizing, we don't like it, but we're still not there yet. I don't even think we're at halftime yet. I think the second half is putting the power back in consumers and us taking ownership of our addiction to free.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great point that you're bringing up. I'm glad that you've brought us to that. So we'll probably come back to that as we go along here. So, you know, given that the mission of the company, how would you describe the mission of the book?
Oh, man, the mission of the book. The mission of the book really is something that Matt and I feel it in our heart. And it's personal for me. As a marketer, I want nothing more than to create really amazing products and experiences. And as a consumer, I want to fall in love with them. I see that you're wearing the North Face jacket right now, right? Like people love that brand. People love Patagonia. And there's no reason to feel guilty for it, right? Yeah. We're not going to live in a consumerless society. But there is this distrust. So my identity that is a marketer doesn't like that my identity as a consumer is at conflict at times because of some of the stuff that happens.
Yeah.
So our driver behind the book was to bridge that gap, right? So it isn't just to point a finger at marketers and say they're evil. It is, and quite frankly, it's only the upper echelon of marketers that know a lot about neuromarketing, right? So Blindsight is about neuromarketing. And it's really to bridge the gap. And our hope is that when we expose, when we show how the sausage is made, we hope that you appreciate the care and effort that goes into it while also finding ways to criticize, right? You're just getting more educated as a consumer. That was our goal. You know, you need Matt, the neuroscientist, and Prince, the neuromarketer, to bust our butts to write that. But I think I think we made it approachable. You know, we didn't want to make it academic, but we researched the hell out of it, right? So you see
did.
Lots of references.
You really did. And I forgot to mention the title of the book here.
Blindsight.
Catch everybody up. It's Blindsight, the way marketing mostly reshapes our brains. And so we can kind of get into that here. There's an interesting, what does blindsight refer to? You start off telling a story about blindsight. Matt, take it away.
Yeah. So this is one of the inspirations behind the title, comes from an observation of a neuropsychological community, called blindsight patients. And these are individuals who, by all intents and purposes, ostensibly have no vision whatsoever. So they ask them, what are you looking at right now? And they say they're blind. Their internal subjective experience is blindness. And yet, when you set up a environment in which they can exhibit some sort of behavioral response, they actually do show evidence of getting visual information and being able to react to it. So there's these very interesting case studies of sitting somebody down in a room, and you ask them, what are they looking at? And they're like, you know, almost insulted by the question. It's like, I'm a blind person. I see nothing. What do you want? You know, what do you want from me? And then you toss them a baseball and they'll just snag it out of midair. And you ask them, well, you know, how did you know that? And they just, you know, it's intuition. It's, I had a feeling. And so it turns out that this neuropsychological community, the underlying neuropsychological damage is to our conscious visual pathway. And we still have residual unconscious visual activity going on. And that's what these individuals are responding to. And so this we thought was such an interesting way of looking at our role as consumers and what it's like to be consumers. So we experience the world, you know, we're sort of reacting to things, we're, you know, dodging things in our environment, and we're sort of, especially in the digital world, in reactive mode. And there is this sort of deeper underlying subjective experience, which we may not actually have access to. And so this sort of struck us as a really interesting analogy to sort of look at us as consumers. And so that was really the inspiration for the title.
Yeah. So as consumers, there's a way in which we're blind, but also a way in which we are unconsciously, just as a blind person who could grab the ball out of the air, we are unconsciously picking up on stuff that influences us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the degree of that is really what your book goes into, with just mm-hmm. tons of examples, which you can feel free to throw in here. I may remind you of a couple, but whatever comes to mind, you know, because all of the examples are so so rich. And this is a whole area, I think, that's been explored. I should let you guys know, I've got a foot in a couple of different worlds myself, both the psychology background, but I've also been involved in market research for about 30 years. And as a market researcher, doing focus groups with consumers for commercial clients. And, you know, so I've had a chance to kind of see some of the both sides of that. And I'm interested in both sides, because one of the things that happens with psychologists, well, even people who are not psychologists who are in the market research realm, is they grab from psychology, you know, they're just eager to get their hands on whatever they can get their hands on that would give a little bit more of a marketing edge, you know. And so it sometimes has alarmed me the way people in that profession have glommed on to neuropsych, and there are companies out there that are marketing that, you know, we're going to hook your potential customers up in fMRI machines or using other technologies, and we'll give you a readout on their emotions, you know, several wavy lines showing their level of arousal and their emotional connection and the positive and the negative and all of that. And it's kind of glommed on to unquestioningly.
Absolutely. Yeah, there is a lot of sort of neuro, sort of, yeah, almost, you know, propaganda out there. I think yes. As soon as you have a, you know, a brain, there was actually a study done on this back in 2008. This is was Wiseman et al. in 2008, where they showed if you're trying to convince somebody of something and you just have a basic argument, you can either explain it in, you know, psychological terms. You say, you know, these behavior results indicate that people had more focus in the morning, or you describe it in terms of a neuroscientific finding. So we saw, you know, heightened activity in hippocampal and parahippocampal areas in morning periods as opposed to afternoon periods. And hands down, the more compelling argument was people found the more compelling argument to be these neuroscientific arguments, even though they're saying exactly the same thing. But if you have a brain in your white paper, it just comes off as much more compelling for some reason. And I think a lot of marketers have sort of, you know, as you say, sort of glommed onto this and actually used neuroscience as a marketing tool for themselves, as opposed to actually, you know, applying the principles there as well.
Yeah.
And I'd like to add to that, if that's okay. I think before we run away with this, I think it's nice to deconstruct what neuromarketing really is. It's the application of neuroscience to marketing, and marketing itself is a big, giant, hairy tree. And you know, neuroscience and psychology is foundational to us as humans. So the applications or the insights are valuable. So that's, you know, that's neuromarketing in a sentence. And Matt and I will stake our reputation on the following statement: there is no buy button, right? So, you know, the moment Matt said propaganda in the context of neuromarketing or behavior science, my first thing was like, buy button. I don't know. There's no buy button.
No buy button in the brain, you mean?
There's no buy button. Don't pay for coaching that shows you the buy button. That's not a thing. It's simply, you know, like, I'm glad, Dave, that you've got this context of market research, because it is pretty foreign for marketers to think about neuroscience. But marketers have this obsession with the scientific method, or at least our translation of the scientific method, which is testing, A-B testing, right? And A-B testing 20 years ago, when analytics and things went digital, was great because it was easy to do. And fast forward to today, we've got so much A-B testing we can do. So as marketers, we think we're super scientific because we know the scientific method as applied to A-B testing. And what Matt would say is that's behavioral. It still tells you nothing about the psychological impact of the A-B test. And yeah. I think we're getting there now. right?
Yeah.
So I would like to say neuromarketing isn't inherently evil or inherently for good. It is right now a hodgepodge of marketers who are trying in their earnest to be scientific and in earnest to provide value to consumers. And then there's obviously the creepy version of this that is nudging without consent. And we can go down that rabbit hole as well. But neuromarketing as a whole is a tool. You know, you can use it for good or bad. And we wrote the book Blindsight so that way consumers know about it immediately, right? Like, we want people to know what a loss firm does to you. We want people to know why you want to go, you know, the basics of pleasure and pain and how that relates to your iPhone obsession, whatever that may be, you know.
Yeah. I just wanted to underline my iPhone that. Obsession. I'm totally marketed away there. This gets us into the area of behavioral economics, right? Is that a lot of what this is? I've had the opportunity to interview Dan Ariely. Maybe you guys are familiar with him.
Oh, of course, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of times. Okay, let's see. You know, so I'm happy to hear that your book is primarily aimed at consumers and give and kind of consumer protection, consumer awareness, if you will, so that we can be aware of all the ways in which we can be manipulated, and rather often kind of subconsciously, because what you guys give example after example of is that the way our brain is constructed, there are some things that we're going to miss, and that smart people have put a lot of energy into studying where those holes and gaps might be so that commercial messages can be slipped in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is actually one of the items that we speak about in the book and open with the book is just looking at human perception, and which is, you know, one of the most fundamental ways in which we come to understand the world. So sensation comes in and we interpret it, and that's our internal subjective feeling. And what we describe in the book is there is this gap between objectivity and subjectivity, between what's true objectively out in the external world and what we feel subjectively internally. And that gap is the marketer's playground. That gap is opportunity. And in so many instances, marketers really get to play in this gap and really get to construct our reality. And that's you know, a huge power and also a huge responsibility. So we talk a lot about the massive influence of placebo effects and the degree to which brands, specifically mass market brands, really rely on placebo effects to shape the consumer experience of using the product. So Coca-Cola being an excellent example of that. So continuing to spend, you know, over $10 billion on advertising, despite the fact that there's not a soul alive who's been alive for the past 50 years who hasn't heard of Coca-Cola before, but they're still going to advertise to it because of the mere exposure effect. Every new additional exposure you have to Coca-Cola advertising, cementing this connection between happiness and Coca-Cola, actually does something to how our brain represents Coca-Cola as a semantic concept. And so then when you pick up and you try a bottle of Coca-Cola, you are going to actually experience it much more in a much more pleasurable way just by virtue of that semantic association. So this is the classic sort of Coke Pepsi challenge of the 90s. If you're drinking, you know, brown fizzy liquid and you're led to believe it's Coke, you'll actually enjoy it much more because the brand itself can act as a very, very powerful placebo. So just one of the many ways in which brands can really play in this gap between subjectivity and objectivity.
That's one of the things I really love about your book, is that you guys aren't afraid to name names. And so you point all of your chock full of examples of major brands that everybody will recognize. And it really brings it home, you know, makes you think about it even more. The Coca-Cola, I seem to have read somewhere that our conception of Santa Claus, as it's presented to us, that the redness of Santa Claus's suit comes from the Coca-Cola logo.
I mean, that's It's a great urban legend. And I'm sure you read far enough into the archives, some will say yes or no. I think, you know, Santa Claus, different parts of the world has been green and some other colors as well. But I think whether or not Coca-Cola made Santa red might be disputable. What is indisputable is nothing makes you smile like Christmas, right? Gift giving, Santa's jolly, right, and Coca-Cola's entire association strategy has been happiness. So why not call dibs, so to speak, on the biggest figure of happiness that we know outside of a yellow smiley face, and that's yellow, right? And Walmart try to do that. But instead, you associate with Santa Claus. So I think the association design is definitely objectively true, although I'm sure we can get advertising historians to argue either way about who made Santa Claus red.
Okay. Okay.
But it's definitely the association of red of Coca-Cola and Santa Claus and happiness that happens to make this perfect little meeting place. And then, you know, just to go off of what we said earlier, we definitely do name some names. We know that we're never going to get hired at Facebook, and that's okay. but we also are trying to be fair to both the brands and the consumers as we talk about this stuff, right? So the fact that you can put people in a fMRI machine and give them unlabeled Coca-Cola versus labeled Coca-Cola and actually see the pleasure center nucleus accumbens light up when they know it's a Coca-Cola means it's not a trick. Your brain is actually getting more pleasure from a soda that a Coca-Cola logo on. So if you enjoy, it's consensual, right? Like you enjoy Coca-Cola more than Pepsi, and the fact that you know what the logo is, all the better. A more tangible example, right? Taste still feels subjective, right? The research about golf clubs, unnamed, Starter, which is considered a budget brand, and Nike golf clubs. Took a bunch of golfers out to the range and had them hit golf balls. And they all drove the ball further with the Nike golf club, when in actuality, it was exact same golf club, a different logo on there. So we're talking real, real objective effects, not perceived effects. And we reached to a point, you know, and here's a punchline, perception is reality. And if Nike is going to help me drive the ball faster, jump higher, maybe feel more confident, whatever that is, thank you, right? Thank you for all the brand managers who were able to pull that behavior out of me without me even knowing it subconsciously. And, but like I said earlier, right, there's two sides to this coin. And there is that piece, that objective value, and how perception is reality in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got a lot of, we can get more into the dynamics that you lay out. One is mental models, that the idea that we construct models in our brain. Take it away, Matt.
No, exactly. I mean, this kind of brings us back to this idea of how perception works. I mean, perception is really our brain's best guess at what we're experiencing in any moment. And so, you know, we never really, you know, experience a bite of food directly. We experience that bite of food via our brain's mental model. So we're always sort of a step removed from that. And so while the actual, you know, sensory stimuli of the bite of food, let's say it's a chocolate piece of chocolate cake, you know, the actual sensory stimuli that's coming in through our gustatory, you know, sensation in the tongue and relayed to relevant areas of the cortex, that's one piece of the mental model. But all sorts of other things outside of direct sensation influences mental model. So your mood at the time, the music that's playing in the restaurant, your expectations about the food. There's all sorts of really interesting studies, especially in the gustatory domain, having to do with the belief about the food. If it's from a family recipe, if it's from a, you know, inspired ingredients from, you know, it's artisanal and these and that, and all these, you know, multisyllabic words that culinary experts like to use to infuse their food with meaning. All of these things are have nothing to do with the actual sensation that we're getting, but influence this mental model. And again, ultimately, we can only ever experience the mental model. We never experience the piece of cake directly. So all of the interesting ways in which marketers can really influence our direct experience of reality through tinkering with these mental models.
Something that you say in relation to mental models is seeing is believing, believing is seeing. Can you fill that out for us?
I'll try. Mental models influence our belief system. And what is a brand if not a designed, architected mental model, right? So if you believe, and this goes back to the Nike example, right? If you believe that your Nike driver does X, Y, and Z to your performance, you know, that's a mental model. You know, the Coke as a happiness symbol is a mental model. Under Armour, the clothing company that is always the underdog, is the mental model they've created via their branding. So that's the belief system.
Yeah. And that's how beliefs. The belief system is part of it. There's a place in your book where you say brands as belief, brands as belief based mental models. So that brings the two together. You talk about something called mental anchoring. Remind me about that.
Yeah, so this is this observation with human attention that really, when it comes to understanding the world around us in terms of what we're paying attention to, we don't experience anything really in absolute terms. Everything is relative to something else. So if you take a test and the score comes out and it is a 7. Is a 7 good? Is a 7 bad? Is that an F, or is that a, you know, it all depends on what the benchmark is. And so, the way that these terms get meaning is it's relevant to some sort of benchmark. So a 7's great if the average in the class was a 2, a 7's amazing. A 7's pretty bad if the average score in the class is like a 95. Everything's relevant to everything's becomes meaningful once it's related to a benchmark. And so this is an observation which is utilized quite a bit in marketing as well, especially when it comes to pricing, because when it comes to a given price, we especially if we're operating under uncertainty, and this is an area that your former guest Dan Ariely has done a lot of work on. We're searching for benchmarks. We're searching for ways to sort of give that number meaning. So this was a study which was done by William Sonoma, and they did this interesting study where nobody knows really how much a bread maker should cost, right? I mean, just offhand, I have no idea how much a bread maker costs, $100, $500. And so they did this interesting experiment where they put a bread maker next to a $250 espresso machine, or they put the same $100 bread maker next to a $450 espresso machine. And the espresso machine, didn't sell at all, but the bread maker sold differently depending on the product that it was situated next to. So these benchmarks can be very, very important.
Fascinating. And you talk about manufacturers' suggested retail price, the MSRP, and you talk about that in relation to Amazon, and we're coming up on Black Friday. Is that this Friday?
So next Friday. Yeah. Yep.
There are all sorts of ways that we're going to be manipulated there.
And I think there's a fun story in here. I mean, a brilliant business person named Ron Johnson. He created the Genius Bars at Apple. He created the entire experiential rebrand for Target, the Chic, the affordable Chic. And a little company called JCPenney was able to poach him and brought him on as CEO. And he was there to rebrand and reposition JCPenney. And when we talk about anchoring, the most easiest way to think about it is MSRP, and then you slash the line, and then you put the lower price. And of course, you're anchoring the $100 price, even if the sweatshirt ends up costing $25. Well, he decided to flip that. And his entire strategy about how to, reboot JCPenney was, we're not doing fictional pricing anymore, right? 95% of JCPenney's revenue comes from sale items. What does that tell you? Everything's on sale all the time, right? Everything at JCPenney is always on sale in some way, shape, or form. And he said, you know what? We're actually going to get rid of fictional pricing, and we're going to end up dropping our asking price, our final price, on most of our products. So at the end of the day, this is a very consumer-friendly move. And let's take a minute to appreciate that, right? Like, you don't get that often. You almost never get that, right? You don't have Apple go, you know what? We're overcharging for this stuff. So let's just drop it down to a super fair price that's lower than before. Like Walmart, they don't do that. They don't publicly say it. They had the entire PR campaign, the ComScan campaign, everything. So what do you think happened? Do you think people went bonkers over JCPenney's? No. People stopped shopping there because they didn't have the context or anchor to the price. They didn't care if the exact same t-shirt a year ago was $5 more. The exact same suit was $50 more, whatever that was. Now, without the MSRP slashed across, we are anchorless in the world of value shopping. And as honest and as appreciable that might be for consumer power and for consumer positivity, right? It didn't work. So they went back to fictional pricing. And guess what happened? Sales went back up. So there we go.
Wow.
No good deed goes unpunished, I guess.
Yeah, really. So it's that kind of, in some ways, we've been trained to, you know, to have that MSRP thing and to anchor it, mm-hmm. as you say, as anchoring our perception of the price and what it means. And you give a great example of Jeff Bezos and how important $100 is, you know, mm-hmm. and to one person, $100 is like a huge amount. And for another person like Jeff Bezos, he might not even pick it up off the ground if it was laying mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, I think, go ahead, Matt.
We see real life examples of that in the consumer world as well. So not just with somebody's, you know, overall wealth, but there's ways in which, depending on the product and the situation, the same $100 doesn't mean the same thing. So if anything is you know, fungible, it is money. If anything is objective, it's money. Like $100 is $100 is $100, but psychologically, it doesn't always feel like $100. So imagine going to Levi's. We have the Levi's Strauss headquarters here in San Francisco. Go to Levi's, you're buying some jeans, and it's $50 for a nice pair of jeans. At the end, they say, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, there's additional tax that we got to put on because of this, that, and the other thing. You know, it's another, you know, $17. And you're like, oh, man, so it's going to be $67 for these pants. Like, then you got to kind of debate on your hands, right? So that $17, yeah. You know, it's not trivial. But imagine, you know, that situation, but you're going to a car dealership. And you're buying a Ford Mustang for $55,000. At the end of it, they say, oh, just to be transparent, you know, this is extra $17 tax. It's a, you know, with this, we had to tighten the bolts on it. It's $17 extra. You're like, $17? I just bought a $55,000 sports car. What do I care about $17 for? But, you know, you should. It's still $17. It still has the same paying power as the $17 on your Levi's purchase. But, you know, relative to this big, the big baseline of a sports car, that $17 doesn't feel psychologically like very much. So yeah.
This is why.
Go ahead, Prince.
Matt knows I love cars and I can't resist. Sorry, Matt. I mean, go into a German car dealership. They'll handsomely charge you for color, which is just outrageous, right? I'm buying a $50,000 BMW and you have the nerve to charge me $250 for aqua blue or Laguna Seca green or Imola red. No, give me colorless car, right? Is that an, oh, that's not an option, right? So that's a perfect example of, you know, when you're dropping whatever it is, of thousands of dollars on a Mercedes E-Class, S-Class, you know, what's a couple hundred bucks for paint, which is total BS, right?
Yeah.
But I there's one thing that's, I think, not talked about enough. That is the connection of anchoring to why we pay attention to stuff. So anchoring, and this is even, you know, I've been in branding classes. I've taught branding classes. And before Matt and I wrote Blindside, this was not a common conversation, which is, yes, anchoring has a lot to do with perceived value and why we buy things we buy. But what we don't talk about anchoring enough is attention. Because what anchoring really talks about is our brain's tendency to pick up patterns. And when you break that pattern is how you grab attention. So companies spend a ton of time and money to figure out a differentiated position in the market, right? So when Coca-Cola, we keep beating up on Coca-Cola. When Coca-Cola decided to be classic Coca-Cola, that's red. Guess what Pepsi could not be? Nothing classic, nothing timeless, and not red. So they went with blue. They could have gone a bunch of other colors, went with blue. And then they want to be the in hip and in touch with the now generation. I'm not saying they're successful at it. That's a conversation for a different time. But their branding strategy should differentiate, right? It's because in a sea of sodas, what's going to grab your attention? Something that deviates. And that has to do with our anchoring.
Right? Zero calories, right?
Well, they did the zero calorie. But I think maybe the better way to illustrate this example is with bottled water. You walk into any Safeway, you know, Whole Foods, gas station, 7-Eleven, you go to the water aisle and there's just water upon water upon water. So your brain is anchored to this generic, vague image of this plastic bottle that's narrow on top, stubby at the bottom. And then there's no way you're going to grab attention when someone is agnostic for the brand. They're not picking a brand. They're just going to grab bottled water unless you break that anchor by deviating. And that's what grabs your attention, right? So then there's a reason to do that. And that is the value of anchoring, but as applied to our attention and what drives our attention.
Yeah, going back to your Pepsi example, how did they break out and differentiate themselves?
So Coca-Cola Classic is literally their thing, right? They did ethnographic research. They did a ton of research before they decided to hit the reset button, and it stayed consistent for quite a bit. And it's this, I think it's best summarized as Coca-Cola belongs in a museum. Pepsi will never go to a museum. Pepsi is the graffiti in Uptown. Pepsi is breaking status quo.
Uh-huh.
That's what they did. If Coca-Cola is status quo and is classic and is timeless, Pepsi is timely, and Pepsi is the exact opposite of that. And then they have to, because Coca-Cola has painted them into a corner, right?
Huh. So interesting.
In a sea of sodas, they got to differentiate, and they have to differentiate from the biggest name there is, and they went the exact opposite direction. It is the proper textbook move. It is the right playbook. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, in the book, you also bring in Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner in, was the prize in economics or in psychology? He's a psychologist.
It was in economics, yeah.
It was in economics. So a psychologist who gets into economics in a major way gets a Nobel Prize. And he identifies that we have two different systems going on in our brain, not actual locations in the brain, but systems. And one that sort of builds on fast thinking. Sometimes we need to make quick decisions. We don't have a lot of time to dig down. Other times we have to be very, very careful, and we want to research and research and research. And there may be, I suspect there are also personality differences that some people would tend to lean towards one. Excuse me, microphone, sorry. Some people would tend to lean one way or the other. And so to me, it's kind of like one of the things that's possible there is a kind of laziness. And so marketers, tell us about how marketers play on fast thinking versus slow thinking.
Yes. So, I mean, Kahneman's work really did break it down to system one, system two, thinking fast and thinking slow. Matt and I tried to put a different frame on it. Uh-huh. And that frame was of cognitive control, right? So before I jump into the marketing aspect, just really quickly want to underline that, right? So it's a bit like you're driving a car and you have both the automatic and the manual transmission. By default, it's going to drive an automatic. Your ability to flip over to the manual mode and start shifting gears manually is cognitive control. And, you know, we like that frame of system one, system two, because it feeds into marketing a bit better, right? So, so when you think about walking into a grocery store and you are trying to eat healthy, so no bad fats and no sugar. So you walk past the ice cream aisle, you don't bat an eye. You walk past the soda aisle and you ignore both Pepsi and Coca-Cola, right? You do all these things and you've got the super healthy cart and you've exhausted your cognitive control, right? You've manually overridden it long enough, but you get to the aisle and here's all the sugary stuff all over again. That is preying on your cognitive control. If you exercise cognitive control for the 45 minutes you're putting stuff in your cart, it's going to be a lot smaller at the end of the shopping experience. And that is a prime example. It's not the only example of that.
You're talking about it at the checkout place, yes, where they've got all these, yeah, sugary
tabloids
treats.
Tabloids and sugar. Yeah. Please tell me what Ryan Reynolds is doing in his sex life. Sure. Okay. Cognitive control. You got me. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever that is. But, you know, another way of doing it, it's just simple. It's simple. Put a timer on it. If you put a timer on it, you're forcing me into a more automatic mode. And I think, you know, Matt, we should tell them about the judge's case that Daniel Kahneman pulled out. I think that's a fun one before we go even further down the marketing rabbit hole.
Yes, I think one of Kahneman's major insights here is that we do absolutely have these two general systems. System one, you know, our fast, intuitive, emotional system is sort of our default, and we prefer to use that as long as possible because it's very parsimonious with respect to cognitive resources. We can just operate in this automatic system one mode all day long. It's not really hard thinking that actually requires the breakdown of glucose and ATP and actual cognitive energy. So we can just do it forever. We don't actually prefer to use system two if we don't have to. This is why sort of the great insight of you know, Kahneman Tversky is so profound, the law of least mental effort. So all things being equal, we prefer to do system one as opposed to more manually thinking system two. We'd only use system two if we really have to. And so because this is a physical system that requires actual resources to feed into it, there was an interesting set of studies done by Daniel Kahneman looking at the effect of mealtime on judges. And he found that these are judges making very, 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 very serious judgments. This is either to grant asylum to somebody into the country or to deny this request. And it turns out that denying this request was pretty easy from just an operational. You just had to, you know, stamp, you know, deny. If you wanted to accept, you had to justify it. You can only, you know, meet a certain amount of the quota. So it's much more cognitively demanding, much more intensive to accept somebody. And so they found that if you looked at the half an hour right before lunchtime, the chances of there being reject was significantly higher, because this is the maximum amount of time that they've had since their last meal. And they are depleted in terms of the fuel for this very intensive system two thinking, which is glucose. So our brain physical system, we need actual fuel to make all these processes and all these synapses fire. And the longer you go until you've replenished your fuel source, the less actual resources you have, and the more likely you're able to just go to this you know, much more parsimonious automatic system, which is system one. And in this case, system one was the reject button. So even judges, people that as a, you know, society, we trust them to make objective judgments about the most important things that the society cares about, even these individuals are still prone to making systematic irrationalities when it comes to their decision making with something as simple as glucose depletion. So, yeah, I think a pretty stunning example of this trade-off between systems.
Yeah, one. I'm wondering about surgeons. It's you know, that same thing has to apply in many other kinds of domains, not just buying and selling.
Absolutely. Yeah, they always say don't go into a negotiation on an empty stomach. And, you know, that adage, I think, intuitively has picked up on this fact that, you know, we're just not our sort of full selves. We're not fully availed of our cognitive resources if we haven't fueled ourselves with you know, food that actually is going to be broken down to make these processes possible.
I knew that about myself recently. My car dealership was wanting to buy my car back because of the need for good used cars. And so I would double the time of the lease, which sounds pretty good for them. And so the only time that I had when I could go and try to deal with this and think it through was in the late afternoon. And I just decided to blow it off because I know that I fall apart if I'm if I'm not well fed.
Oh yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah. You talk about the fallibility of memory and that marketers exploit the fallibility of memory. What would be some examples of that?
Yeah, this is probably, if I had to, gun to my head, I had to pick one, sort of the favorite, my favorite chapter of the book is really diving into memory. It was such a joy to write about that we actually was the one psychological phenomena that we actually wrote about across multiple chapters. And so memory is such a fascinating mental process, because it's one in which I think we just get so wrong intuitively. So we sort of feel as humans that, you know, as you're going about your day, as you're having experiences, you have the record button on. You're just taking all of this, you know, information in. And then, you know, later you're sort of reflecting on what you did last week and you're just pressing, you know, the rewind button or the replay button. And it turns out that neither of these are true. So when we're having an experience, we're not taking in the full range of stimuli and activity. And then when you're pressing the replay button, it's not a faithful recollection of the objective experience you had, but it is really a recreation given the context you're in when you're remembering it, given the mood you're in, given the story you want to tell, all of these forces which are playing into this recreative process. So there are many, in this case, these gaps between subjectivity and objectivity when it comes to memory. And this is a way that marketers really come in and create some incredible experiences and also play into our recollection of memories as well.
Yeah, and I think you've pointed out that a person's values can also color their memories. Just a whole lot of factors that can influence and color what we think is and what a married couple, such as myself, situation. You can feel very certain that you remember it the right way and she doesn't remember it the right way. She got a whole different version of what happened. One of the ways that's playing out in my own life is due to the pandemic, we've been watching a lot of TV and a lot of Netflix stuff and so on.
Oh, yeah.
And so a number of times she'll say, hey, you want to watch this? Oh, well, I think I saw it too recently. I'm going to remember the whole thing. But we go ahead and watch it anyway. And I didn't remember any of it. Maybe there was one little key thing in it that got planted in my memory and I thought that's what the whole film was about. And so there's just been repeated instances of this where we watch something that I was reluctant to watch and I'm totally entertained because it's like I'm watching it for the first time. This probably has something to do with my age, but I think it also underscores what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's memory is one of those you know, fascinating elements of the human experience that we all, you know, we have, you know, traces of the past that we, you know, are sort of hanging on to. And then, you know, our brains, you do some very elaborate confabulation from there and create, you know, entirely different memories that we may have not actually had experienced. So maybe you remembered the movie to be completely different than the way it actually is, because you remember this one chunk, and then your brain probably extrapolated a bit out from there. And maybe that was, you know, in your memory, that was what the whole movie was about.
Exactly. Yeah. You talk about the role of pleasure and pain. You even have a little formula when it comes to purchasing things. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is, if we really had to be very, very reductionist about any given purchase, it would be this, that the likelihood of purchase is the amount of pleasure that you're going to derive from that product minus the pain of the price. So pleasure minus pain equals the likelihood of purchase. And so on the one hand, it's this very sort of simple, straightforward formula. It's actually pioneered by the work of Brian Knutson down at Stanford University, who did this looking at the neural underpinnings of pleasure and the neural underpinnings of pain in response to products and to the prospect of paying for them, and found the delta between those, and found that delta was very predictive of the likelihood of actual behavioral purchase. So it does have some nice grounding empirically. So it does sort of start out as a really, really nice framework. What's interesting, though, is when we sort of unpack it, neither one of these variables are straightforward at all. So, you know, what we're going to experience in terms of the pleasure of a given product is very, very difficult for us to predict. We're you know, and Dan Ariely again has done incredible work on this. So we're really, really bad predictors of what is going to make us happy in the future. So we have really, really poor effective forecasting, to use Dan Gilbert's term.
Yeah,
so
I was thinking of him. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So this whole issue of pleasure and what's going to deliver us pleasure and can we predict that ahead of time, especially through consumer purchases, is a really, really nebulous area. And then, as we spoke about a little bit already, this idea of pain and the pain of paying. So yes, of course, the actual objective dollar amount is going to give us pain, but also how this is framed to us. Is this an add-on on a $50,000 BMW, or is this an add-on on a, $50 pair of jeans? So the actual amount of pain that we experience is going to be determined by a number of contextual cues as well. So the
question or the pain, the pain might be guilt, maybe. I mean, I think we all have that experience of, do I indulge this guilty pleasure or not,
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's ways in which marketers actually, deal with that as well. There's this really interesting research from Columbia University on the functional alibi, where, you have these very sort of hedonically driven purchases, like you're going to, purchase a Hummer, for example, for $100,000, and not the new EV Hummer, the old school Hummer, that is just this gas guzzling crazy thing. Yeah. And, nobody buys this for any, sort of non-hedonic reason. It's just pure, nucleus accumbens motivation. But they found that if you put a little, feature on the vehicle saying, oh, it has the best safety ratings or it has this or that, and you ask the person afterwards, well, why'd you buy the Hummer? And they use that to justify their response after the fact. So they, oh, I bought it because it's, a safe family vehicle. I bought it because, I'm concerned with, my family's safety, et cetera, et cetera. Likely didn't have anything to do with the purchase, but the fact that they have these nice little things that you can sort of justify your purchase with later actually seems to do a lot in terms of helping us explain our own behavior, which is helpful to do.
It's not like I have warlike fantasies and this is really going to make me, I could roll over anybody else out there. I could squash their car.
Exactly. Nobody will tell you that in the post interview, but they will say, they'll point out the little thing that they can sort of justify this big indulgent purchase
right.
for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Kind of a leitmotif that runs through the book has to do with what we might call the economy of attention, that our attention is extremely valuable and is for sale.
I would love to explain that. I mean, that's the attention economy is a term popularized by Tristan Harris, the person behind Social Dilemma. And what Matt and I like to rephrase that as the time of sight model, or if you allow us to be bold, we call it addiction 2.0. So it's worth deconstructing that a bit, right? So by all means, we're not minimizing the addiction people may have to heroin and all of these other addictive substances. But what we are talking about here is, I alluded to this earlier, our addiction isn't so much to the social media apps alone. Our addiction is to free. And because of that free addiction, if we are not going to pay for these products we spent hours a day, right, on these social media platforms, if we're not going to pay for that, someone else will pay for our eyeballs looking at that screen, and hence the attention economy. Now, put yourself in the shoes of someone who's creating that product. We have billions of people who use your product and no one wants to pay. But someone wants to pay for access to those billions of people. The longer you keep them using your product, the more you can charge the people who are willing to pay, right? So that's the attention economy, or addiction 2.0. It's, it's probably more, it's not addiction in the traditional sense. And I'm sure, Dave, you're more qualified to talk about from the psychotherapy section of how deep the addiction roots go. But what Matt and I are saying is really compulsive behavior, right? It is all these free apps that are based on how much time you spend on them are designed to optimize for compulsive behavior. And that's the economy.
One of the things that has stuck with me from The Social Dilemma is one of the guys, and you probably know who it is, talked about that he came up with the innovation of likes so that, you know, you could get likes. And and that, I guess, tickles the pleasure centers in the brain. They said that is so powerful. These guys, when I thought of this, it was to do something nice for the world, you know, spread joy and good feeling. But it turns out that for many people, they become addicted. Maybe all of us at some level have a vulnerability. We all want to be liked. And again, talk about the relativity of things, $100 and so on. If you were getting 100 likes every day, and then suddenly you're getting 10 likes, that's upsetting to people. And magnify that. You know, we know that teenagers have committed suicide for the loss of status that they experience, or the feeling like they're pariahs, that they're no longer accepted. So to me, that feels like really serious ethical issues there.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you brought this up with this idea of likes. And so the likes aspect is really powerful for a couple of reasons. So one, it plays into this idea of variable reward that we talked about in the book. So sometimes, you know, you open up your app and, you know, you're going to have 10 likes. Sometimes you're going to get 15 likes. It's going to be generally positive, but you don't know how positive it is. And this variability in terms of the pleasure you're going to experience is very, very enchanting to our brain's dopaminergic system. It's this unpredictability of reward that keeps us coming back again and again. And it's also really interesting from, as you mentioned, that the social standpoint. And so a lot of these apps, especially, of course, on social media, do have a way of providing social currency and social validation. And so we can look at the activity of people on social media and pining for likes and views and followers and things like that, and think this is a, you know, a totally crazy Gen Z behavior. But this is a very, very a classic idea within social psychology. So going back to Leon Festinger in the 1960s, I mean, his primary insight was that people are fundamentally driven to understand their true value, that this is a fundamental social drive. And in social media, this sort of teases that to a certain extent, because you, again, are in a situation where there is no objective right amount. So just like, you know, a score of 7 on a test isn't good or bad, you need some sort of benchmark. This is, again, Leon Festinger's great insight, is that we engage in social benchmarking. So is, you know, 70 likes good for a, you know, a delicious, you know, brunch that you took a picture of and posted on your Instagram? I don't know. 70 likes is good if all your friends got 30 likes. 70 likes is not good if all your friends got 500 likes. So everything is relative to these social benchmarking. And one of the reasons why I think, especially in younger populations, you mentioned teenagers, why this can get difficult is this engaging in social comparison can have very, very deleterious effects for self-esteem. And so especially engaging in what Susan Fiske would call upward comparison, where you are constantly feeling like everybody in your social group is above you. They're getting more likes, they have more status, they have more social equity than you do. Engaging in upward comparison can be very worrisome for self-esteem and self-efficacy.
One of the other things that really distressed me about this is that some of the guys at these social media companies said that, you know, they're using their training in psychology and in neuropsych to make the games as sticky as possible. That is, that people will, what's the other term that's used to make people want to keep coming back? And they say they were saying that it works on them. They designed it. They know how it works. And yet they have trouble not looking at their iPhone 20 or 30 or 50 times a day.
Yeah, it was. I think it was, I'm blanking on the name, Pinterest. It was the person who worked at Pinterest. Like, well, I work all day to try to make this stuff, keep the engagement metrics up.
Engagement, and, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah,
of course. And we talk about this in the book. We're like, what is, you know, a nice way of saying addiction is engagement in the world of tech, right? You call it addiction, people look at you weird. If you call it, we have engagement that's 20% year over year, and people invest money in you, right? But he talks about that. He talks about how he worked on the product to make it more engaging and have people stay on it longer. And then he came home and he knew exactly what he's doing. And he still couldn't help but open Pinterest himself as a consumer of it. It's fascinating. I mean, it's... you know, in many ways, I think social networks have scaled this, but this is something that video games, certain video games have used for a long time, right? So Matt just talked about unpredictable rewards. Well, we've had video games that give you unpredictable rewards since, you know, while George W. Bush was president. And that's not anything new. It's just there are a lot more people who... use social networks than there were who played War of Warcraft or some of these older games, if that's what they do.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps you playing more and more. You kill a monster, you don't know if you're going to get a sword or an axe or a new horse to ride around. Yeah. Like, you don't know. And then not knowing is what keeps you going. And that is the same not knowing that keeps you from scrolling, right? Like,
and that works on lab rats. You know, you don't have to. You don't have to go up to the higher functioning of the brain. You know, random schedules of reinforcement lead to perseveration, if you will, of behavior. But hey, we're running out of time here. There's so much more in the book, so people will have to read the book to really find out all the nuggets that are there. As we start to wind down here. As you look in your crystal ball, what do you see for the future of marketing, and should we be scared?
I'll take this first. I don't think there's cause to be scared. I think there is cause to understand marketing more than we do now. I think there is that, but I don't think it's fear. I don't think... you know, looking down at the crystal ball, I have a gut feeling that people are going to know a bit more about marketing and data than they do now. In the same way, we know a little bit more about what in the world these cookies are on a browser than we did 10 years ago.
So right? we need to become smarter consumers.
Smarter, mindful consumers. Without fully villainizing. Now, some companies... feel free to villainize, right? But it's, you know, the answer to bad marketing is no marketing. The answer to bad marketing is better marketing. And for every shady experiment that Facebook has run, there's plenty of other companies making amazing products that they want to charm your pants off. And so you as a consumer, I think over time, I'm going to say 7 years, if you're going to force me to put a number down, I think around 7 years, we're going to have a better understanding of what data ownership means truly and how that affects our buying behavior. Now we're not, and look, this is why we wrote the book, right? We saw this coming years ago. And, but it was also, you know, when Matt and I talked about this, we also wanted to own the fact that we like buying stuff, right? We like spending times on these apps, some of them healthy, some not. Yeah. That's it. Once we get better educated on how this affects our psychology, we can pick and choose our adventures in the consumer world. And we wrote the book Blindsight to help be that step in that direction, to earnestly be that step in that direction. So that's my call. In 7 years, we're going to be more educated. Why seven? Okay. I like the number seven today.
Matt, what's your wrap up? I saw you nodding your head when I first posed the question of, should we be scared? Did I see you nodding your head?
No, it's a great question. I mean, if you know, we can get a bit speculative with it. I mean, I do think if you look, for example, at certain trends that are happening outside of marketing, this is going to really impact what we see in the next decade or so. So the major trend that I'm seeing right now is with trust. So if you follow the Edelman report, for example, year on year out, so it's a big organization, they study trust in institutions and forms of government and political figures, et cetera. And really across the board, no matter how you look at it, we're in this really, really intense downturn in terms of trust. Some of the lowest trust numbers ever in terms of sort of this decentralization of trust. And so I think there's this sort of vacuum when it comes to trust, and brands that are able to come into that space and really establish genuine, earn the trust of consumers are going to be incredibly successful. Because now it's not, you know, what, you know, the New York Times says is the best product of the year. It's what a, you know, an influencer or a certain, you know, person your social life says. There's been this decentralization of trust. And so I think that will pose some challenges for established brands, but also some opportunities for younger, newer brands as well. So, yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes and how that unfolds.
Okay, well, you guys are the white hats as opposed to the black hats out there. And so I thank you for aligning with the white hats, and keep up your good work. And thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. These were two great guests for feeding my interest in the downsides of social media. I hope that all my listeners have been able to view the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. The Social Dilemma became particularly relevant in the section of the interview where we were discussing addiction. The evidence they present in their book clearly supports that addiction is one of the many dynamics that can play into our brand preferences and purchase choices. I was surprised that Prince seemed to downplay its power when we were discussing addiction to our devices and social media. Of course, he's the marketer in the pair and seemed to go to some lengths to remind us that marketing is not bad, that we are all consumers and want to have good products. When I asked at the end of the interview if we should be scared by any of the marketing tactics they cover in their book, his answer was no. However, to me, that flies in the face of the mission of their company and their book, which I see as warning us consumers to beware of falling prey to marketing techniques that take advantage of some of the vulnerabilities in our brains. Nevertheless, I think their book is an excellent contribution to the consumer protection movement. Clearly, our brains did not evolve to handle all that we're confronted with in this current era. The authors do a beautiful job of taking the reader through a whole catalog of our vulnerabilities. And if we can keep them in mind, we might stand a better chance of not getting bamboozled. And as I said in the interview, I love the way they dramatize their argument by using examples of major brands and ad campaigns that we all will immediately recognize. Their book is intended for a general readership, and at the same time is grounded in the latest neuropsychological research and extensively referenced. Once again, the book is Blindsight, The Way Marketing Mostly Reshapes Our Brains by Matt Johnson, PhD, and Prince Guman.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's me, Dr. Ahmed Al-Akhouri, a psychiatrist from Alexandria, Egypt. I am a follower for your blog and radio for more than 5 years. I like the episodes whose content is sometimes practical, pragmatic, and down to earth, and sometimes is philosophical and theoretical. I like both approaches. I like your guests, all mental health professionals. Also, I like your disciplined way and speaking style. Your insights regards the union approach got me interested in it. I call my colleagues in mental health profession all around the world to support the Shrink Wrap Radio by donations, so it can continue and get more developed and effective. Thank you, Dr. Dev.
Thank you, Ahmed, all the way from Alexandria, Egypt. I so appreciate you for being a steadfast listener and for your financial support. And again, I want to thank all of our regular donors out there. Remember, too, that one-time donations are also welcome on our site. And at the same time, I know times are tight for many and appreciate all my listeners, whether they can help support this work financially or not. So with that, we'll wrap it up once again. And thanks again to neuroscientist Matt Johnson, PhD, and marketer Prince Guman for discussing their book, Blindsight, The Mostly Hidden Ways Marketing Reshapes Our Brain. Next week, we'll again feature two guests, Phil Wolfson, MD, and licensed marriage and family counselor Sonny Strasberg, who together head up the Indra's Net Coalition, which is dedicated to ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.